pushing for minimum wage increases and pushing for 15 at the bargaining table all across the state. I mean, all of these organizations are doing all kinds of different things that are all contributing to the movement for 15.
Well, we want to thank you, Justin, and we'll be shouting out for you. This is KBOO, Portland, 90.7 Labor Radio. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye. Have a good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Cable Community Radio is accepting Toys for a Toy Drive conducted by McLaren's leadership in collaboration with McLaren Community Voice. The toys will be used during family visits for young family members visiting their loved ones in the McLaren Youth Authority. KB will have a barrel in their lobby from June 2nd to the 14th and will accept toys, stuffed animals in new or gently used condition. We will not turn down any donations. Your donations will be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm Karen James. Voices from Solitary was an event held May 13th at Portland State University. It was sponsored by PSU Students United for Nonviolence. The event began with the film screening of Herman's House and was followed by a panel who shared experiences in solitary confinement. The film, Herman's House, is about Herman Wallace, who spent decades in solitary confinement in the Louisiana Angola prison. Jackie Sumil, a young New York artist, wrote Wallace a letter and asked an extraordinary question. What kind of house does a man who has lived in a 6-foot by 9-foot cell for over 30 years dream of? The film is an account of how imagining Wallace's dream home, which began as a game, became an interrogation of justice and punishment in America. The Voices from Solitary panelists are Tom Hastings, Gretchen Valla, Tammy Wilkins, and Philip Gruhl. The poster for the event was designed by Jamie Amaya, an artist currently in solitary in Oregon. The event was organized and emceed by Corinne Fletcher.
I just also wanted to mention that Herman Wallace ended up spending 42 years in solitary confinement, and he did win his appeal after 42 years, and so he was released, and he died within a week of his release, but he died in freedom, which is beautiful. This film is really powerful for me because it shows activism through art, but then it also shows the importance and the value of relationships and how freeing those are for people who are incarcerated, and especially for people who are in solitary confinement, and how much survival and freedom those relationships bring. Tom, do you want to begin?
I'm sure that my experience is probably a lot more lightweight than most folks who have served time in the hole. My imprisonment was due to what we call a plowshare action, which is to go out and dismantle part of the weaponry that is used to kill people. So like Herman and like the Angola 3, unlike them, I was in there 100% for nonviolence, but like them, I was a political prisoner. And so I got an awful lot of respect from fellow inmates and an awful lot of disrespect from the guards and the prison personnel for a while. The reason I went to the hole and a very short stay, just 3 weeks, was that I wrote a letter to my co-defendant saying that turns out that the United States Thermonuclear Navy was going to get restitution no matter what my circumstances were, that even if I refused to work and draw my 26 cents an hour wages, that they would still get something like 4 cents an hour to eventually pay them back the many thousands of dollars of damage that I did to their, that we did to their thermonuclear command center. So I said, so it looks like the only way that I can get out of paying is either to, you know, commit suicide or escape. So the next day, two burly guards were in my cell and basically strapped me up with all kinds of chains, everything they owned, I think, ankles and belly chains and everything else, and sort of walked me out to the van. And these two guys did nothing else all day long but drive me 175 miles south to the maximum security prison. And when you go in there, if you're in a van and you're heading for the hole, they're examining everything with mirrors and making sure that your nonviolent prisoner hasn't got something nefarious going on. So then they threw me in there, and immediately a bunch of my friends started a letter writing campaign because they knew that I wanted to be in the prison camp where I had eventually made it to. You go through several levels of security before you finally achieve a prison camp. And I had gotten there, and I'd gotten my job, which was tutor and librarian, and I liked it. And so the next thing, I'm in the hole, and so they started a nice campaign. It took about 3 weeks, and then I was out. But the thing that I noticed about it was my mind started to go. You're in basically sensory deprivation, and you can't, I couldn't. I mean, I've got a doctorate. I'm not an entirely stupid person, but I could feel it evaporating, losing touch with reality. And I have friends. I have one friend of mine is a priest who was in the SHU in SeaTac for a long time, and I was his mail mule. He would send me like 6-7 letters, and I would, with the addresses, and I'd distribute them, you know, repackage and distribute those. And we had a correspondence going once or twice a week, and I could see, over a period of 3 years, the same thing happened to his mind. He was a Jesuit priest who, these people are trained in how to survive that kind of stuff. And he was losing touch with reality. I don't know how people, I don't know what they come up with. Like the guy in this film, Herman, I'm watching this dialogue and that guy is like a rock to me. I don't know how he came up with the wherewithal to survive that amount of solitary. I just found it far worse. When I was in population, I got along with the other inmates, great. In fact, they all wanted nonviolence training, but the attitudes of the prisoners was wonderful. But you start taking people away from each other, you remove and destroy community, and that's what we need. We're human beings, we need each other.
And Gretchen?
I'm going to speak at this coming from a little bit different direction. I haven't experienced this firsthand, but I have experienced it from visiting my son, who was sentenced to 13 years when he was 21 years old. And in Oregon, we have something called Measure 11, which is a mandatory minimum sentence. So in my son's case, he had 90 months mandatory minimum and then a consecutive sentence of an additional 66 months. So during the first 90 months, and this is one of the problems with mandatory minimums in Oregon, during the first 90 months, there are no incentives for good behavior. So my son did sort of whatever he wanted to during that time, and he ended up spending about half of his 90 months in segregation. So the first 2 years, he was at OSP, which is, you know, a 45-minute drive, not, you know, not horrible from the Portland area. The next 8 years, he was at Snake River, which is, well, depending on how fast you drive, between 6 to 8 hours in Ontario, Oregon. One of the things I noticed in this video is that he was able to make phone calls, even though he was in segregation. But when you're in segregation in an Oregon prison, you don't get to make phone calls. The only contact you have with people is if your family comes to visit you. And we visited him once a month as much as possible, 6-hour drive for a 1-hour visit. Some of the, I think, atrocities that happen when you visit or when someone in segregation has a visit is, so they're back in the bowels of the prison. You know, there are additional doors upon doors and, you know, corrections officers upon corrections officers. And when you have a visit, they bring you into like the little visiting room. It's a no contact visit, and you're in 5-point chains, which means, you know, your hands are tied to your waist and you've got, you know, the chains around your ankles and stuff. You're not going anywhere. And then during the visit, they chain you to the wall. So, you know, in every situation, there can also be some positives. I think the human spirit has strengths that you don't know sometimes until they're put to the test. So the good news is he's on transitional leave, a 90-day transitional leave. He got out on March 11. You know, he's always had a sense of humor, and even when horrible things were happening, he got through it because somehow or other he found the lighter side of things. Quite amazing. There are envelopes here addressed to people who are in segregation. Human contact is so important. If you have a little bit of time and you can write to somebody who's in segregation, you'll open up a new world to them.
My name's Tammy, and you know, I can relate to a lot. People were talking about Herman's ease and positivity of just having acclimated to the situation that he was in. When I was in segregation, I was brand new to the Department of Corrections. I was 18 years old, and I'd come through some childhood abuse, some of the disturbances with the state. They were trying to put me in foster care. I picked up a IV drug habit, and I ended up at the penitentiary when I was 18. So the facility at the time, it was a very small facility. They had like 147 women. It was actually one of the old medical units for the OSP, Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. The women's unit back in those days was an extension of OSP, and it used to be a medical unit when they first built the penitentiary. So it only housed 147 women. It was really small. Everybody wore, well, they had just stopped wearing their own clothes. And I get in there, and I knew a few people from Portland, and they were trying to get some, they had some construction going on. We hadn't had laundry facilities for a while, and they hadn't opened up any of the educational opportunities from the men's penitentiary, which where all of the services went at the time was to the men's penitentiary, because we were so small, they really didn't have anything for women at that time. And so these women decided they were going to have a sit-down demonstration in the yard at count time. And I'm barely 18. It's the first time I've been there. I had no concept of what safety and security meant, and you don't have to spend very much time into a facility to know all of a sudden how important count time is and to do exactly what you're told at count time. So there was like 28 of us that sat out in the yard, and we stayed arms locked together. They were trying to bring attention to you know, the lack of services for women at the time, but what they got the attention of was like the SWAT team and some snipers and, you know, quite a bit of news coverage, but it wasn't at all what they intended. And it certainly wasn't what I thought was coming. And at the time, they only had like 4 SEG units in the building at that time that they used for isolation or lockdown. So they had to close down an entire wing, move all the girls out of this other wing of the facility, and then turn this entire makeshift wing of, I mean, a whole 25% of the population just about into a lockdown segregation unit. So when we went in, they sentenced us all to a year. And once you get into that sentencing grid, the guy that runs the hearings for the people and decides what your sentence should be, they decided to double it. So they initially gave all of us 2 years in segregation, and they charged us for all the overtime for the SWAT team and all the officers. And, you know, I mean, that sounds, looking back on it, that seemed as devastating as thinking about the fact that I just been served a 10-year sentence with a 30-month minimum, which is 2.5 years, and I thought I was going to spend 2 years of it in lockdown. And the hardest part for the situation is I was so young. My mom hadn't been able to visit me. The facility didn't release any information about what was happening. It was all over the news. And she was worried.
She was worried.
It's okay. So, you know, I like what Gretchen was saying here. You know, it's not just about the people that are in the SEG unit themselves. It's about the families and the lack of contact and the lack of access. You know, there's so many lives that are affected besides the one that's in there. Now, I was sad going in, and, you know, what I remember mostly is just the pain, the physical pain of sitting on a bunk or at a table that many hours a day. You know, you can't lay down anymore. Your back, your neck, everything just screams, and there's just nowhere to go. And for us, when they gave us our time out, they would give us a couple showers a week, and then they would give us what they called a walk. And it wasn't really a walk. You got to go from the inside of your door to the outside of your door for a 6-foot pace, you know, for however long. But you had to go through a strip search and a pat down to get that. And so I frequently just skipped it. It was pointless. And so I just laid a lot, and I read a lot of books. And, you know, and I do think that you do acclimate to your surrounding. You know, once you've adjusted or surrendered to what you're experiencing, then everything slows down. And then it comes time for when you get out of SEG, you have to reacclimate to all the added stimuli, you know, it didn't surprise me when they said he went back after 8 months into SEG. You know, by that point, you can't handle other people. You can't handle the stress, the confusion, the attitudes, you know, you just lose some of the skills it takes to have coping skills, you know, and when you live in a community environment, you have to have a lot of coping skills, you know, because there's like people everywhere all the time in your face, and there's no time to yourself. So going from one extreme to the other is just like from ice to hot. So they had started some step-down procedures, bringing people out of that SEG situation later on. Some of them got to come out a little bit at a time, but they didn't do that with the first of us that were released. I only ended up doing 6 months myself because I'd only been there 7 days, and they did an investigation on levels of involvement. The organizers of it got the full 2 years, and I watched them come out because I was still there when they came out. By the time I finished doing time, I had been incarcerated 15 years. I got out in 07, and I'm still learning how to live on this side of the gate. So it's nice that he had the imagination to build a house. I'm 9 years out of the gate and I still don't have a picture on my wall. I don't decorate my environment. You know, there's just some things that tend to be more work than they are pleasure, and I've accepted that. But you know, those are some of the lingering effects of having basically spent majority of my entire adult life incarcerated. So that's my experience with SEG.
My name's Phil. I did 26 and a half years. I was locked up from 1988 till just June of last year. I did over 20 years at Oregon State Penitentiary, a little less than a year at Snake River, 2 years at OSCI, and got shipped out of state because of my behavior for another 2 years. And I've been in and out of the hole many times. But the rule or their criteria when you go to the hole is you get strip searched, you go through the strip searching and stuff. But when you get into wherever cell you're at, it's just like it's approximately this big as Herman's cell. But you have two bunks in there. So you got two guys living in a little room like that. You know, back in the 80s, just like, you know, how Herman was doing his time, how the system is, the system was way different than it is now. It was more the guards can do whatever they want and you can scream as loud as you want because nobody can hear you. And they did what they want. There's guys in the hole for like over 9 years and with no means of getting out, just like the committee that sees Herman every 90 days, they have the same committee over there. And if they don't want you out of the hole, you're not getting out of the hole. And then you have corrupt guards. You got corruption everywhere. But what gives the guards the advantage over the inmates is that when you're locked in your cell and they want to get you, then they'll come en masse, open your door and go in your cell and you up. You know, they still do that. And but overall, the going to the hole, I've been to the hole for sometimes no reason at all, just for investigation. Just they can do that. They can say for security reasons. And that is an umbrella that covers everything. And they don't have to give a reason, security. So I've been in the hole many times for just security reasons. I had a cellie, he OD'd. I went to the hole and got rode up for him ODing because we were cellies. So I almost got a sanction behind that. And the only reason I didn't is because they gave me a UA, and my UA came back clean. So if my UA would have came back dirty, they would have gave me a sanction. He almost died. He was in the hospital for 5 days. He wound up going to the hole for like 6 months with a $14,000 medical bill. You know, so they fine you, and basically they keep you in so far down that you can never get up. So if you got fines and you work, the state takes your money right away. So you got these guys living in poverty in prison. When they keep you down, then that creates and breeds corruption, because they have to make money, they have to do something, so they start hustling, selling drugs, selling black market stuff, which leads you back to the hole. So it's a cycle that the system perpetuates, and it's hard to get out of it. You know, for me, finally, you know, one of my last times in the hole, I realized I was like in my 40s. I was like, man, what am I doing in the hole? I'm not even trying to change my behavior. And so the last time I was in the hole is I wound up getting into the Inside College program, graduated Inside through Chemeketa, and now I go to Portland State.
Does anybody have any questions? The question was, long-term, how do you deal with the anger?
I think the key to everything for me is figuring out how to replace this whole justice system with restorative justice, so that the second that somebody gets arrested, we start with rehabilitation, we start with restoration. We're worried about not just the perpetrator, we're worried about the victims, we're worried about the community, we're worried about the families on all sides of every issue, and we're worried about getting people skilled up. Why don't we help people try to figure out how to get that sort of restorative process going? You know, figure out ways to be creative. As the film said, you know, going on 2.5 million people in prisons, and most of them in there for nonviolent crimes. Even the ones who are violent, there should be a restorative process going on. Because at the end of the day, almost every single one of them is getting out. Society, enlightened self-interest. Everybody's going to be back with us. Why not help them in that time really get ready to come back and be in a good place when they do?
The question is, what would you say to somebody who basically says prison changed your life and for the better, that you were transformed for the better, and therefore it's a good thing and a necessary thing?
No, it wasn't prison that turned me around. It was reentry. It was the opportunity to have something that would bridge me from prison. Because of the fact that I went 6 times, when I got there, I had a 7th grade education. I'd never been in school. I'd never had a job. I'd never had an apartment. I basically did all of my middle life developmental stages behind bars, so I didn't know how to pay bills. I knew how to operate in that environment without causing too much trouble after that first mess. But that wasn't what helped me be successful out here. What helped me be successful out here was finding a way to be a part of the community where I knew I could be a part of the community. I had internalized my guilt or culpability to the point where I just honestly said I never thought I could actually acclimate to being out here. So I started school as an extension of I've never had a job. I don't know how to use a computer. I don't know what I'm going to do. I got to go to school. So that's what I did. And then I had a lot of community support out here that got me through those rough years. Those first 3 or 4 years out, it was really, really, really hard to learn how to be a grown up. And I mean, I was like a little kid in a grown-up body, but you know, it just took time to make some choices and to learn that I had some of those abilities to do that. And it wasn't prison per se that turned me around, though. It wasn't. It's kind of what stunted me from ever empowering myself to begin with.
The gentleman who said, you know, people who are in prison deserve to be in prison, and they did something to get them there. And I think it's probably more of an unenlightened attitude. And, you know, once again, I'm going to throw us into the state of Oregon, where we are, and mandatory minimums. And we definitely need to see some sentencing reform. And I don't know the statistic, but I'm going to throw one out that I think I'm pretty close. I think it's probably between 60 and 70% of people who go to prison go on a plea bargain. They accept the plea bargain because there's a fear that if they go to court, if they go to trial, that their sentence will be longer. And district attorneys have a lot of power in the state of Oregon, and this is how people end up in prison. So I think when the gentleman said, you know, people who are in prison deserve to be there, well, Not necessarily in Oregon. People are in prison because they're coerced.
And so I'm actually going to really quickly invite Patty up here to speak on mental illness, people who have mental illnesses who are kept in solitary confinement, and just to remind everyone about Senate Bill 739, which would ban solitary confinement for people who have mental illnesses.
So I'm Patty Katz. I've been to prison 5 times. I have 27 parole violations, so I kept going back to prison because I couldn't stop doing heroin. When I first got to prison, I met a young woman who was sentenced when she was 18 years old for a 3-year sentence. In those days, we were on the metric system. She probably would have been in prison maybe less than a year on that 3-year sentence. She had mental illness, and she got touched by one of the officers. She got grabbed by her hair and her collar, and she came out fighting because it touched something off in her. She turned around, and a bunch of the cops were on her, beating her up. She fought back, and she broke one of the officers' backs. So on her 3-year sentence, that probably would have been less than 1 year, she went to the hole for 10 years. She got outside charges, and she went to the hole. And they kept trying to bring her out like they did with the gentleman in the film. And she would come out into general population, and her eyes would just be spinning. And they would put her out, like, at lunchtime when everybody in the institution was out. And she would just be spinning, and she'd want to say hi to everybody. And she had 2 officers standing behind her all the time. They were double-teaming her the whole time. She was treated very unfairly. And when she got out, her family helped her sue Department of Corrections, and she won several million dollars. Her house was firebombed, I mean, within a few months after being released from prison, and she died. We have built a mental health prison within the prison, but we have got to stop putting people with mental illness in prison.
Please contact your Oregon state legislators to urge their support for Senate Bill 739 that will stop solitary confinement for persons with mental illness in Oregon prisons.
Oregon actually just partnered with the Vera Institute for Justice to reduce the amount of use of solitary confinement and reduce the amount of use for long-term solitary confinement. And I just wanted to share that when Mississippi reduced the number of people held in solitary confinement from 1,000 to 100 people, incidents of violence within the facility decreased by almost 70%. So solitary confinement does not create a safer facility. In fact, it probably increases violence. So I kind of wanted to ask about ideas for alternatives to solitary confinement from people who have spent time in solitary confinement.
Segregation is necessary, I guess. It's necessary to a point. But solitary confinement really messes with your brain. You know, if they just limited the time of solitary, and then, like at OSP, you got different blocks. So when you get out of the hole, you're in an E block, and you can't move out of E block for 6 months, and after 6 months, you can move to D block. After 6 months, then you can move to C block, and then after 5 years, then you can move to honor unit. So it's a transitional hierarchy thing going on. But these guys that just get out of the hole, they still have no incentive. They can't check out a basketball. They can't join a softball team. They got so much limitations that they just say, fuck it, and they do what they want and go back to the hole. So they're not creating anything for these guys that already did their sentence in the hole, and now they're still being punished. You know, so there's many things they can do. They can give them a job because there's always something to clean up or do or just give these guys some kind of work skill or anything, and they just choose not to do it. You know, so they can do education, they can do all kinds of stuff, but they're not utilizing it, or the guards really don't care, because it creates a negative cycle among inmates, which keeps them disruptive, which fits their means of then nothing can really get done when we're fighting amongst ourselves. You know, so what reform can we really do when everybody's against each other?
Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Michael. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Underground Grad School series titled Portland's Urban Native Americans, What You Need to Know to Be an Ally. Classes will be Wednesdays at 7 at Southeast Uplift in Portland. The first class, June 10th, will focus on the context for urban natives of Portland. Current studies estimate at least 60% of Native people live off-reservation. Historically, this is no accident. Discover why it's important to understand the unique characteristics of urban Indians compared to other non-white urban populations and to their reservation counterparts. Again, that's Portland's Urban Native Americans, What You Need to Know to Be an Ally. Wednesdays at 7 at Southeast Uplift, 3534 Southeast Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Kick me one of them funky ass beats.
Tune in Thursday, June 19th at 10 p.m. for a special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. We'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive, entertaining, and intimate festival. Again, be sure to tune in at 10 p.m. Thursday, June 19th for our What the Festival broadcast here on KBOO Community Radio. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 7 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's KBOO's weekly broadcast of the River Signal. This is episode 2.